Chapter 3. The Crime. The sheriff and his newbie constable were going through a small box on his desk. Also on the desktop was a large pot of coffee and a half dozen freshly baked cinnamon donuts from Doris the Donut Queen's newly opened shop, which was the talk of the town. "Okay, constable, these are the facts as we know them. One, Cleek Clemens, local land baron at the time around here, was playing golf with his soon-to-be son-in-law, Tim Carl. Tim back then was just new in the land development business and was eager to purchase some prime beach property and get started. He was engaged to Emmy Lou, Cleet's daughter, who was known to dabble in hard drugs from time to time." "I don't see this in the report," Jessica said as she rapidly scanned the notes in front of her. "You'll just find the facts from the crime scene reports, but your sheriff knows all the back stories," he said with an all-knowing smile. "Tell me more," she said, curiously wanting to know everything her grandfather knew and hopefully discover that missing piece of the puzzle that was overlooked 25 years ago. "Well, according to Tim Carl, whom I believe in my gut orchestrated Cleet Clemens's murder, told us the very peculiar tale. They were on the par 3 18th hole, and Cleet had already teed off and hit a shot dead center down the fairway and in position for an easy layup for a potential birdie." "What does that have to do with the murder?" "Maybe it's nothing, or maybe it's something. Hush now, Constable Stanton, and let this wise old sheriff ramble on. First rule of being a good cop is to be a great listener. A good cop always sees or senses something that no one else does. Now, where was I? He just shot a perfect layup for a potential birdie." "Yes, of course. Well, according to Tim, as he reached into his golf bag to retrieve his driver, he heard a sharp, high-pitched sound. Then he turned just in time to see Cleet Clemens get hit in the temple with a golf ball and then collapsed in front of him." "What happened next?" Jessica was on the edge of her seat. "Patience, Constable." The sheriff drank the last of the coffee in his cup and then continued. "Again, according to Tim, he immediately started screaming for help. Jacob Jeebs, the head groundskeeper, was the first to arrive on the scene. Being an army veteran, he ran over and took Cleet's pulse and checked for other vital signs but couldn't find any. By this time, according to Jacob, Tim was freaking out and sweating profusely that he thought he was going to have a heart attack or something. So he made Tim get into the golf cart Jacob had arrived in and drove back to the clubhouse, and Jacob called me. I arrived on the scene about 10 minutes later, breaking every speed limit along the way. I had also called the coroner's office and requested him to come to the golf course immediately. First, I went to see Jacob and Tim in the clubhouse bar. Tim was just finishing his second scotch when I arrived, and Jacob, with no beverage in front of him, sat opposite him at the table. I asked Jacob where the body was, and he told me. I went to the 18th tee, and there he was. About 6 feet away from Cleet's limp, dead corpse was a golf ball with blood on it. There was also blood on the side of Cleet's head. I stared at the crime scene for as long as it took the medical exam team to arrive, which was about 15 minutes. I walked around the tee-off area looking for anything out of place, but found nothing. I then went back to the clubhouse, where I found Jacob and Tim still at the bar. Tim was clearly inebriated by this time and was slurring his words when I questioned him. Every question I asked Tim, Jacob answered, as he had already interrogated him about every aspect of what had happened while he was still sober. Jacob was also a Vietnam vet, but he did his tour in 1960. He was like all of the vets who came home in the next decade. They were not heralded as heroes, but shunned as warmongers and barbarians. It was a sad time for America, and the masses turned upon those who believed they were fighting for delivering freedom to a persecuted people who longed for that basic universal individual right. They were lied to. It wasn't their fault, but they paid the price, and not the bureaucrats who put them there in the first place. They were spit at and shamed for things they had nothing to do with. This was a hard burden to bear for men who merely volunteered and those who were drafted to serve. Where are you going with this, Sheriff? I know your story and what you went through. At least I know all you decided to tell me. Is there something more? She asked, concerned, as she could see sweat forming on her grandfather's forehead. No, Jessica, I've told you all I remember and all you need to know. I was trying to get around to the point of telling you that Jacob Jeebs was a medical student when he got drafted. He was in his third year. He was on a full scholarship, and his family was poor, and he was also black. I know of 5 medical students who were in his same class, all of them white boys who came from old money, so none of them got drafted. You know, Jessica, 2 of those dumbass pricks never even graduated, and the other 3 did. And you know what? All 3 of them have lost their licenses over malpractice suits. Jacob to this day knows more about medicine than most doctors have forgotten. If I feel something is ailing me, I go talk to Jacob first and not Doc Crockett. Sheriff, I'm taking this all in, but where are we going with it? I just want to tell you as much about Jacob Jeebs as I know before you go and interview him and Ida Mae Campbell, Jacob's 3rd and hopefully last wife. You know, he could have been a great doctor. After his tour of duty, his scholarship was gone, and there was no VA program at the time for him to resume his studies. Jessica had at least 12 questions to ask him, but she hesitated because she knew that interrupting him would be futile. It was best for her just to listen and learn. Instead, Jacob returned from the war with a purple heart and a lifetime limp to show for it. He saved 2 fellow soldiers from sudden death by his unselfish actions, and the best job he could land when he got back was as an assistant groundskeeper at the golf course. It was shameful, but I didn't realize it until years later, since I was only an adolescent at the time. Sheriff, help me here. Jessica said, pleading to understand where her grandfather was going with all this information. Jacob Jeebs deserved better in life, the sheriff said while he poured himself a fresh coffee. So do a lot of people, Jessica said, knowing a few. Well, Jacob should have been at the front of the line. To cut to the chase, the coroner concluded that Cleet was killed because of being hit in the temple with a golf ball. He reached over and snatched a donut from the box and had a sip of coffee. Before you say it, yes, people get hit in the head with golf balls all the time, especially in Florida. The coroner at the time, Doc Robbins, ran all kinds of tests and sought out experts of all sorts from far and wide. The velocity of a golf ball to cause the indentation that was on the side of Cleet's head is impossible for a human to do. No PGA pro could at the time, and I'm positive none could today. He could tell he was confusing her, so he switched gears. Let me put it to you in cop speak you can understand clearly. Let's say the number 1 golfer in the world generates a club speed of 200 miles an hour. Jessica nodded her head. Well, the ball that killed Cleet had a club speed of 600 miles an hour, which is impossible for a human to achieve. So there you have it. No case, a prime suspect, but no concrete evidence. Then how was he killed? Hit in the head with a golf ball that had to have been fired out of a cannon or something. And nobody saw anything except Tim Carl, and I know he was lying about something. Everything was too perfect, just like the magic bullet that killed JFK. What about the high-pitched sound he supposedly heard? You hit the nail on the head there, Constable. There were 4 other golfers on the course 2 holes back, and they heard nothing. Of course, they do remember a commercial jet flying over near the time of the incident that could have muffled the sound of whatever Tim Carl claimed he heard, this supposed phantom sound. So, what do you want me to do? Spend the rest of your morning going over what's in the box. There are a few crime scene photos you can look at after you've fully digested your donut. Then at 2 o'clock this afternoon, you're expected at Shady Acres Senior Estates, Cabin 7, where Ida May is going to tickle your palate as she fills your belly. Jacob will fill your head with memories of days gone by, he said, smiling fondly at an old memory. So, what aren't you telling me? I know you too well. What are you holding back and why? Well, you would notice in the first 10 minutes anyways, but it would be cruel of me not to tell you. Jacob Jeebs was diagnosed with Alzheimer's early last year. That's why they moved to that fancy Shady Acres place. I thought Jacob was a poor man. He was until he won $10 million in the Florida State Lottery 2 years ago. Now he can do whatever he wants, but have no memory of it. Well then, why would you want me to talk to him? Ask him anything that happened more than 5 years ago, and his memory is impeccable. Maybe even sharper than a person without. He hesitated before speaking, because it truly ached him in his heart to put a label on what was happening to his dear friend Jacob. Without is the wrong word. I should have said his memory is even sharper than any other normal human in certain circumstances. The judge and I have gone fishing with Jacob every Sunday morning for about the last 20 years after his first wife died. Talk to him about what happened that day at the golf course. Study the file and find some questions to ask him. Sorry to interrupt, but again, why me? And from what you're telling me, it seems like you'd be the best person to do the interview. I mean, you've known him, like, forever, she said, showing her age. That's exactly why I need you to do it, he said, stressing the word need. We know each other too well, and we'd get sidetracked talking about fishing and other stuff. Besides, I want a fresh pair of eyes and a different point of view on this. Jessica was listening intently and nodding her head in agreement. Jacob is 75 years old now and still has an eye for the ladies, if you know what I mean, he said, giving her that all-knowing look that she had seen many times over the years. So, he's your basic dirty old man? No, he's a special dirty old man who can be very charming. He'll open up to you and tell you stuff he'd never tell me. Who knows? Maybe he'll give you the memory we need. I have to go and take care of a few things, and I'll meet you back here later this afternoon. All right, Sheriff. I'll see you then. Jessica said, noticing that Billy Bob had just entered the building and was walking toward her grandfather's office. Sheriff, may I talk to you a minute, please? Sergeant Billy Bob Bozeman said, standing in the doorway. Yeah, let's go talk outside so Constable Stanton can get on with her work, the sheriff said, picking up the box with the two remaining donuts in it, and followed the sergeant outside. Jessica got up and closed the door behind them. She had a lot to think about. Her gramps had dumped an albatross in her lap. If the smartest man she knew in the world couldn't solve this case after 25 years, what chance did she have? She reached into the box and took out the crime scene photos.